the humor of the subject with the help of Alfred Marx.
There was a young man of Japan whose limericks never would scan. When they said it was so, he replied, "Yes, I know, but I always try to get as many words into the last line as I possibly can."
I met a girl once who brought out all the poetry within me. She had lips like petals.
Bicycle petals.
Ears like flowers.
Cauliflowers.
No. Ears were like shells.
Cowards are shells.
She had a skin like a peach.
Or what?
And teeth like stars.
They came out at night.
I hate you.
Keats was so used to receiving bills when he was young that after he'd written Ode to a Nightingale and Ode to Melancholy, he wrote Ode to the Butcher, Ode to the Baker, and this is a final demand.
I said, Alfred,
which poet had his head in the gallery and feet in the stalls?
Longfellow.
Which poet wrote all his poems in the synagogue?
Rabbi Burns.
What are you suffering from if you don't like poetry?
Gray's allergy. There you go. Three dogs died and went to heaven, but St. Peter stopped them at the pearly gates and wouldn't allow them in. Why not, the dogs asked.
Well, the saint explained, you're animals, you don't have souls.
The dog said, what are souls? They said, well, human beings have souls, and that means they're capable of great works of art and literature.
Oh, that's all right, said the animals. We write music and poetry. Do you, said St. Peter. Well, who are you?
Well, I'm Bart. That's Offenbart, and this one writes doggerel.
You do know, don't you, that Milton wrote Paradise Lost.
And that's my side, and he wrote Paradise Regained.
The regimental sergeant major was bawling out his squad on the parade square.
Right! Here's a new training program starting tomorrow on culture. Got it? Culture! The first item on the course will be Electron Keats. And I'll bet most of you audible lot don't even know what a Keats is!
Poetry is the most extreme of the arts. At its best, it has a sublime insight into life. At its worst, it's pretentious and ridiculous. And like a shadow haunting poetry is verse. Some verse never pretends to be more than just verse. But some poetry doesn't quite make it as poetry, and that becomes verse too. Poetic qualities are not easily defined, and some authorities feel that they are the exclusive prerogative of the young. Here's Robert Graves' view.
Most poets are dead by their late 20s.
Well, certainly when applied to Wordsworth. And Wordsworth defined poetry thus.
Poetry is the spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings. It takes its origin from emotion recollected in tranquility.
But some people are a bit wary of spontaneous overflows and have a more cynical view of the art.
Pierre-Jean-Georges Cabanis. Poetry and religion are the product of the small intestines.
I said that poetry is insight, and this is very well summed up in a superb image by Mark Twain.
Prose wanders around with a lantern and laboriously schedules and verifies the details and particulars of a valley and its frame of crags and peaks. Then poetry comes and lays bare the whole landscape with a single splendid flat.
And another remarkable definition by Don Marquis.
Poetry is what Milton saw when he went blind.
That's the fact, that it can provide that sort of insight that makes poetry so important. And makes it important that one should learn about the great poetic figures of the past.
Of all the poets, my favourite period is the age of the Romantics, which is usually about 25. Greatest of these, in scout terms, was William Wordsworth. William Wordsworth, as all know, fell in love with the lakes. The romantic possibilities of women had been used up by Sheets and Kelly. And Wordsworth was a pastoral elegiac poet, or Lakeland Poof. I I'm sure you're all acquainted with his beautiful poem, Two Daffodils. You may not be aware that it was written in Scouse, and I would like to finish this evening by reciting Wordsworth's poem, Two Daffodils, in the original. Two Daffodils. I wandered, dozy, with me care, up Brownlow Hill to take me wealth, when of a sudden I seen a tart that almost made me eyeballs melt. Here are then, Gail. Hey, be my bait. Me throat went dry like at the wave. What other Judy could I take in through the alehouse door each night? What other fellow wouldn't go all green with envy at the sight? Jet white of hair, with orange gob, green eyelids, cheeks a rosy blob, more really sexy she could look than pictures in a drawing book. And as she walked, her hips were rocking. Me heart was pounding, something shocking. I looked and looked. Oh, what a twit. It surely learned me, didn't it? For while this Judy broke me heart, some other swine had robbed me cart.
That was from Peter Maloney. The poetry enthusiast should be well read and keep up with the current trends in the medium. But if he doesn't, there's always a perfect let out expressed in this epigram, Take Heart, Illiterates, by Justin Richardson.
For years a secret shame destroyed my peace. I'd not read Eliot or nor MacNeice. But now I think of thought that brings me hope. Neither had Chaucer, Shakespeare, Milton, Pope.
Perhaps one should take that message to heart and start with a grounding in the classics before tackling the modern stuff. But one must bear in mind that poems which are now classics were modern when they were first written and were criticised as such. This is how Theodore Hook greeted a great poetic milestone.
Shelley styles his new poem Prometheus Unbound, and 'tis like to remain so while time circles round, for surely an age would be spent in the finding a reader so weak as to pay for the binding.
And in 1815, when Sir Walter Scott published his very long, tedious and dull poem, Field of Waterloo, it elicited this response from Thomas Lord Erskine.
On Waterloo's ensanguined plain lie tens of thousands of the slain, but none by sabre or by shot fell half so flat as Walter Scott.
That particular poem is not one that's been heavily anthologized. It does get quoted rather a lot. And the result is that lines which were originally excellent become cliches just by repetition. Some years ago, there was a New Statesman competition to get round this problem by adding an unexpected line to the much-quoted one. Here's H.A.C. Evans's addition to a famous line of W.B. Yeats.
When you're old and grey and full of sleep, you haven't got to bother counting sheep.
Mary Demetriades tinkered with Oliver Goldsmith.
When lovely woman stoops to folly, the evening can be awfully jolly.
And June Mercer Langfield on a famous line of Shakespeare's.
Full fathom five thy father lies. His aqualung was the wrong size.
Perhaps we should break into the proceedings here with a most delightful little poem by Alan Bennett, Going to the Excuse Me.
It's awfully difficult writing poetry. I write poetry, and gosh, it's awfully difficult. This is what I've written about going to the excuse me. Building Vedas, Shanks new Nisa, the trusty Litchfield swirls it down to filter beds on rice-lipped marshes from my loo in Kentish Town. The Burlington, the Rochester, oh, those names of childhood loos. Nessie knocking at the door, have you done your number two? Lady typist, office party, golly, all that gassy beer, tripping home down Hendon Parkway to her improved Windermere. Chelsea buns and lounge bar pasties Horse will down with Benskin's tail, purified and cleansed by charcoal. Silver taps in Collindale. Here I sit, alone and 60, bald and fat and full of sin. Cold the seat and loud the cistern as I read the harpy tune.
Superb piece from Alan Bennett in the manner of John Betjeman. Poets can write about anything, as you've seen.
And traditionally their work
is romantic, and even risque, part of that old myth about artists creating their own standards. Here's a report from the West Lancashire Evening Gazette.
On oath, Mrs. Blank told the court that she was sorry for having sent such a letter. She said she was a poet of no mean order, and she believed it was a privilege of genius to be a little indecent.
Housewife poets can find poetry in everything. News from the Hants and Sussex Gazette.
A visit to a Reading biscuit factory by members of Steep Woman's Institute inspired Miss Blank to write a poem which will be sent to the factory as a mark of appreciation.
Crumbs.
Another basic fact about almost all poets is that they're poor.
In the 18th century, the aspiring versifier could perhaps find himself a patron to support him and then spend the rest of his days writing his patron's praises. Nowadays, poets are reduced to writing in praise of the Arts Council. There's not a lot of money in the poetry game. Addison Misner.
Poets are born, not paid.
Albert Ellsworth Thomas.
It takes a major operation to extract money from a minor poet.
One way that a poet can make money is to turn his talent to the commercial world and write advertising copy. This has been a possible outlet for poets for many more years than you think. In fact, Lord Byron was once accused of receiving £600 a year, a lot of money in those days, for writing verse in praise of Warren's shoe blacking. When challenged, he wouldn't deny or confirm the charge, and it's quite possible that Lord Byron was responsible for this little commercial jingle, which was published in Bell's Life in 1835.
"Friend," said Aminadab to Obadiah, "why such amazement do thy features show to see Abinadab thy boots on fire, and thou stand harmless in the burning glow? Our friend, dost thou so of discernment lack? Art thou so far to common knowledge barren? Not to perceive 'tis but the radiant black that's manufactured by friend Robert Warren."
As you see, poetry turns up in unexpected places.
With all this ready-made entertainment available at the touch of a button, do you think there still exists within people the urge to write?
Well, all I can say to that, darling, is wolves. Anywhere in London, it ain't whitewashed for long, is it? I mean, the grubby little pencils are out, scribbling on there. Kilroy was here. Happy New Year to all our readers. I mean, there's probably as much feeling gone into Fred Fancy's flow than the whole of Charles Dickens' Romeo and Juliet. I mean, it's a lovely walk. I tell you, there's a wash and brush up in Chatham. I've never read poetry like it. Beautiful it is. The meter, it scans, it's poetic, you know. One or two spelling mistakes. And some of them illustrated. Lovely. It shows vivid imagination in that, isn't it? It's a beautiful sight. It really is. You should go and have a look. Oh, you can't see it. Well, it really is beautiful there.
Why do you suppose that they find inspiration in a place like that?
The solitude. The magic of the moment. This feeling of being cut off. I mean, how can you define me in tangerine?
Benny Hill, reducing poetry to graffiti. Because the emotional stakes in poetry are so high, because it aims at such perfection of expression, it's inevitable the failure rate is also high. English literature is full of attacks on bad poets. Alexander Pope.
Pensive poets painful vigils keep, sleepless themselves to give their readers sleep.
Samuel Taylor Coleridge on a bad poem.
Your poem must eternal be, dear sir, it cannot fail, for 'tis incomprehensible and wants both head and tail.
The obscurity of some poetry brings to mind James I's remark on John Donne.
Dr. Donne's verses are like the peace of God. They pass all understanding.
Here's a national offensive epigram by Matthew Prior.
Sir, I admit your general rule that every poet is a fool, but you yourself may serve to show it that every fool is not a poet.
Many such strictures on bad poetry are quite justified. There's a lot of it about. Apart from the famous example of William McGonagall, the great bad poet, there have also been some pretty mediocre stuff churned out by the giants of English literature. In 1930, D.B. Wyndham Lewis and Charles Lee published an anthology of bad verse called The Stuffed Owl, and to their researchers we have the following examples. First, from Lee Hunt.
The two divinest things that man has got, a lovely woman in a rural spot.
And another one, it didn't quite mean what he wrote, was William Nathan Stedman.
And when upon your dainty breast I lay my wearied head, more soft than eiderdown.
Religious fervor can lead to a curious poetry, as some unnamed writers of hymns proved. Here's one.
Earth from afar has heard thy fame, and worms have learned to lisp thy name.
Hark, I can hear a worm lisping. In many cases, the names of the authors of these deathless lines have not come down to us. For example, this funeral elegy upon the death of George Sons, Esquire, written in 1658, is anonymous.
Reach me a handkerchief, another yet, and yet another, for the last is wet.
We've got three already. Quoting them all. Nor do we know the name of the young tradesman poet responsible for this love lyric.
No more will I endure love's pleasing pain, nor round my heart's leg tie his galling chain.
There's a handful of words. Now this is the best though. This anonymous housemaid poet.
O moon, when I gaze on thy beautiful face careering along through the boundaries of space, the thought has often come into my mind, if I ever shall see thy glorious behind.
Let's change the mood now and listen to a poem by Roger McGough. It's actually meant to be amusing.
Now a poem about the dreams, the erotic dreams of a bus conductress.
Let's go. And the sort of bus she'd like to see. It's called My Bus Seductress.
She's as beautiful as bus tickets and smells of old cash. Drinks Guinness, soft UT.
Eats sausage and mash.
But like everyone else, she has her bus dreams too.
When the peak hour's over and there's nothing to do.
A poster upstairs, a jukebox inside, but on more ways than one of enjoying the ride. Velvet curtains on the windows, thick carpets on the floor, roulette under the stairs, a bar by the door. Three times a day she performs a striptease, and during the applause, say nicely,
"Pass, please."
She reserves the men of her choice, invite them along in her best clippy voice. She knows it sounds silly.
What would the police say?
But thinks we'd be happier if she had her way. There are so many young men she'd like to know better. Give herself with a change if only they'd let her. Beautiful as bus tickets and smells of old cash. Drinks Guinness, soft UT, eats sausage and mash. But she has her bus dreams hot and nervous. My blue serge queen of the transport service.
Wasn't that nice? Roger McGough. Poetry is more than just a transference of emotion. It's also a highly skilled craft. There are all the problems of meter and, of course, of rhyme. When does a poem need to rhyme and when doesn't it matter? Let's hear an anonymous limerick.
There was an old man of Dunoon who always ate soup with a fork. For he said, as I eat, neither fish, fowl, nor flesh, I should otherwise finish too quick.
There have been many experiments with different kinds of rhyme down the ages. But some authorities think that rhyme in any form is demeaning and prefer the majesty of blank verse. Here's part of a jokey experiment made by Thomas Hood.
Anon, night comes, and with her wings brings things, such as, with his poetic tongue, young sung, the gas upblazes with its white, bright light, and paralytic watchmen prowl,
how well,
about the streets to take up Pall Mall Sal, who, hasting to her nightly job, robs Bob. Now thieves who enter for your cash, smash, crash, pass drowsy Charlie in a deep sleep creep. But frightened by policeman B3 flee. And while they're going, whisper low, no go.
Perhaps the answer is to have shorter poems. Here's Justin Richardson's cut-down version of the famous poem by Thomas Gray.
The curfew tees the quay of parking day. The village elders and the churchyard plot might have been famous men like E.G. Gray, but famous people also die. So what?
He says for short poems. Here's one from Julian Orchard, introduced by Spike Milligan.
A real cheerful romantic poet, Roland Milk, reads his own bovine pastoral.
Lovely big cow by the edge of the wood. I'll give you an apple if you are good. I want to be kind before the chance goes. For Aunt Sarah told me, and she always knew, that somebody told her. I hope he was wrong. You'll be put in a bottle before very long. So, lovely big cow, whose hide is all mottled, do eat up your apple before you get bottled.
Taken from the world of Beachcomber. Recitation is still quite a popular form of entertainment, and an enthusiastic minority regularly attend poetry readings. Modern poets tend to mumble and slouch a bit at their readings. And don't run the risks of the man reading the charge of the Light Brigade in this limerick by Ambrose Bierce.
There was a young reader who thundered and lightened and rode the 600, but he got no applause for his effort because his trousers he sadly had sundered.
There's all sorts of poetry on this program, isn't it? As I say, that wouldn't happen nowadays. A lot of modern poets are distrustful of over-dramatic readings. But then modern poets have always been a strange bunch. Here's Lord Dunsany on the subject.
Modern poets are bells of lead. They should tinkle melodiously, but usually they just clunk.
They also tend to take themselves a bit seriously at their poetry reading.
Now keep quiet and listen to Rupert. I've called this poem Blank Details.
Ah, yes.
Blank Details, yes. Let's see now. I feel a sort of purple mood coming over me. I think for this I shall sit cross-legged on the floor, yogi style, with one foot tucked around my neck. Hang on a minute. Hang on, sit right. I mean, proceed. Blank Detail by Rupert.
Straw in the wind. 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 Fly, fly, fly.
Can I read my poem now?
Pardon?
I just written a poem. Can I read it?
I somehow don't think the sort of poem you write will be suitable for this guy. We are not interested in young ladies from various parts of the country.
Oh, no. I've written an abstract poem.
Oh, don't be ridiculous.
One has to be sympathetic with the symbolism of existence to turn out that sort of stuff.
Get back on the sideboard.
Oh, now let's hear what Madame Savage has written. It might provide some light relief after the intensity of the last two offerings.
Oh, very well. Make it quick and keep it clean.
Thank you.
Incandescent by William. Hick, hack, hock. Rinky tinky on purple grass. Shafts of light. Hobnailed boots tramping down the bamboo that grows upwards, downwards, sideways into the concrete cosmos. Life is mauve. I am orange. Hick, hack, hock.
What a load of rubbish.
You buffoon. Rinky tinky on purple grass. What does that mean?
You're orange and life is mauve.
I have never heard such unadulterated codswallop in my life.
Get back in the sideboard this minute.
How dare you speak to a genius like that? I'll never be able to wipe such masterpieces as that.
But he's a dolt. He can't do anything.
Can't do anything? In a few brilliantly conceived lines, he's summed up the human capacity for suffering and his struggle for survival.
Oh, come now, Gregory.
Surely it was empty, devoid of any symbolism. You made a mistake. He fooled you for a moment. Analyze it. Bamboo. Hobnailed boots.
Well, it doesn't mean anything to me, mate.
My order of perception didn't even wobble.
Peter, what do you think?
Well, it was like a revelation. It transported me to another plane. For the first time, I saw the fifth dimension, like a golden flash cleaving the skies. I was transported to the heights of delirium.
See what you've done now? She's off.
Johnny Hancock, Bill Kerr, Fenella Fielding, Fraser Carr, and Warren Mitchell. And that's pretty well the end of our look at poetry. Let's end on a suitably melancholy note with an obituary by Anthony Broad.
Critics sipping cups of tea, praise between their trumpets. Drunken poets, men who cried ha-ha among the strumpets. It's sad. Kind words are seldom said until a rake is safely dead.
Next week, we'll be going into the art of conversation. Until then, from Alfred and me, goodbye,
goodbye, goodbye. Parting is such sweet sorrow.
Don't go on like that. I'll be seeing you tomorrow. Oh.
Frank Muir Goes into Poetry was produced by Simon Brett and John Davis.